Summer brings with it many opportunities for enjoying the outdoors and digging in the dirt. It also gives us numerous chances to interact with some of Earth's smallest residents. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and it's Horticulture Day. They may drive you crazy, but there is a lot to learn and even love about ants. Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis will be here today in defense of ants. Later in the hour, we'll talk plants with ISU Extension horticulturist Richard Giron. And of course, Richard and Donald will answer your questions. 866-780-9100. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day, and later this hour, Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Giron and DNR District Forester Mark Vitosh will be here to answer your questions. But first, they were on Earth long before humans, and the odds are good that they'll be here long after we go. Ants are plentiful, adaptable, and annoying as they can be, they are also beneficial. Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis is here to help us understand these much maligned insects. Hello, Donald.
Hello, Charity. Good to be here.
And somebody commented on the promo for the show and said, Charity sounds so happy about ants.
Well, we can be happy about ants.
Right, but a lot of people are not. And you probably get a lot of calls from people who ask you, how can I get rid of these ants?
About half of my life seems people who call with rants about ants. And they just don't like them, and they don't. And primarily, it's this little subgroup of ants that either invade our houses or they cause damage to our trees, our hollow trees, or they're digging in the lawn. And those things are annoying to us and to our sense of propriety in the world. So we do get lots of complaints about ants, but it's such a small number that are causing us problems that I like to step back and say, what about all the others that you never noticed?
Well, and give us an idea of all of the others that we've never noticed, because there are a lot of ants out there.
It's a little hard to pin down how many kinds of ants there are in the world. If you go to some of our various sources and look up how many species, how many different kinds of ants are there in the world, you'll find one authority that states quite authoritatively 8,800 different species, and another website will say it's 11,700 species, and a third source that I looked at this morning said, no, it's 14,000 different species of ants in the world. Of course, here in the upper Midwest, we wouldn't have nearly that number of species, but this is huge diversity when you think about one kind of animal has diversified and spread itself out across the face of the earth to take on 11 to 14,000 different unique forms. That's just incredible.
How many different species of ants do you think live in Iowa?
Well, our best guess is 700 here in the United States, and I don't know that we've done a good study, but I'm guessing 50 to 75 species of ants live in Iowa. If we could get out into the prairie remnants and find all of those species that we've kind of ignored over time. One of the problems with identifying ants is when you get down to the species level, a lot of them look alike. And it takes a pretty good specialist to make those determinations. And while I can identify the major different groups of ants, to identify the exact species is something that's beyond my skill set at the moment. So it's a wild guess to say 50 or more species of ants in Iowa.
Well, and I said that ants came long before us. What do we know about how old these species are?
Well, the estimate is that they've been here for 80 to 145 million years. That means they were here when the dinosaurs were here. And when the dinosaurs disappeared through mass extinction 65 million years ago, the ants just kept on trucking. So they were here with the dinosaurs, and they're still here now. And like the cockroaches and some other pests, they will be here even after we're gone.
All right. Well, let's talk about that claim that they are beneficial, because as I mentioned, a lot of people find them to be very annoying. So what do ants do that is beneficial.
One of the things I like to remind my students is that in the opening scene of the movie Bug's Life, the animated movie where the ants are working, what are they doing? They are collecting seeds and putting them into storage. And that collection and dispersal of seeds is one of the things that ants do that helps the ecosystem. They help plants that can't get up and move around. They help plants move around through the ecosystem by dispersing their seeds. So even something as simple as helping the plants get to new locations would be part of that. The other thing that ants do is many of the species dig in the soil. And that tunneling, that burrowing, that excavation that they do underground is important for getting water and oxygen into the soil where it can benefit the roots of plants and also benefit water penetration and other things that are necessary. So just the amount of excavation they do rivals that of the earthworms, which we know are beneficial to have in our soil. The other thing that ants do for our ecosystem is many of the species are predators. They eat other insects. And so the fact that they are out there gobbling up the eggs of insects, that they are capturing caterpillars and chopping them up and eating them, those are all things that are benefiting us as an ecological service in the form of being a predator. Finally, ants sometimes visit flowers and pick up nectar and pollen, so we put them in our pollinator list along with the bees and the butterflies that we've spoken so much about.
How about the ants that live in my yard or in my garden on a microcosm scale? What can I think about that makes me feel a little bit better about their presence when they are driving me crazy?
Yeah. Well, number one, I would think of them as predators, that they're eating, and some of them are seed feeders, and some of them are insect eaters, and some of them are scavengers. So there's some things they are doing that might be a little bit of an indirect benefit to you. Aerating the soil is one of those things we like, but every once in a while, we will plant our strawberry plant or we'll put our tree or our new shrub right on an anthill. And in that case, excavating the soil away from the roots causes the plant to dry out. So they can be harmful to newly planted plants. And in that case, we might try to move to reduce the number of ants in that area. But that aeration, allowing water to penetrate the soil, and predation are the things that we should try to remember and keep in mind.
All right. And there are so many of them. And of course, they live together. Let's talk a little bit about the social structure of that anthill.
It's a society. It's a society that has been compared to ours in some way. But ants are social, which means a couple of specific things. One, there's a division of labor. There are those that reproduce and there are those who work. And those will always remain separate. There is care for the next generation, which is not common among insects. Moths and butterflies lay their eggs on a plant. They fly away. They never come back to see how their offspring turned out. They never come back to help their offspring. But in the case of social insects like ants and honeybees, they are taking care of the next generation. And they have castes that there are different jobs for different members of the colony. So it's very much a society. It's highly regulated. It's highly organized. There's a job to do, and each one does their job and spends their whole life doing that job.
Now, occasionally I will stumble into an anthill and damage it on accident. I know a lot of people try to get rid of them on purpose, but let's say you just disrupt an anthill. How do ants recover from that?
In a couple of different ways. One thing to think about is ants, like butterflies and beetles, have a complete life cycle of four stages: egg, larva, pupa, and adult. So eggs are laid by the queen, and the larvae are tended by the workers until they are fully grown, at which point they go into a pupa and transform to the adult stage, and then they can become a worker and contribute to the colony. As larvae, they were dependent on the colony to support them and keep them alive. When you disturb an ant colony, it's interesting that one of the things they do is every worker grabs a pupa. Okay, these are the ones that are almost ready to develop into the adult stage. They no longer need to be fed and cared for. The pupa is on its way to becoming the adult ant. And one of the ways to help the colony recover is take a pupa with you, which will be a worker in a short period of time and will help you reestablish. If it's too scattered, a colony can disperse to the point that it's no longer alive, but there are always other colonies of that species that can move in and re-inhabit that area. But I'm fascinated by this behavior of grabbing a pupa and taking it with you when a colony is disturbed.
Now, something that a lot of people have noticed when they stumble into an anthill is that sometimes they will get bitten by ants. There are some kinds of ants that seem to bite more than others. Do they all bite if they feel like they're in danger?
All ants have chewing mouth parts. That is, they have mandibles with which they chop up their food, with which they carry the seeds, with which they carry the larvae and pupae around. And all of them can pinch if disturbed and if harassed and if threatened enough. One of the quick things to say, though, is we do not have fire ants in Iowa. People who have been to Texas, Oklahoma, down south, they know there are anthills that if you disturb them, they will swarm over you and they will sting. That is, it's like a wasp that injects venom with the stinger that's on their tail into their abdomen. We do not have those kinds of ants in Iowa, so we don't have to worry about severe stinging or severe reactions to disturbing anthills, but they will bite in defense, and that's all they can do. That's the best they can do is pinch you and try to make you regret what you've done.
Now that we are appreciating these creatures a little bit more, I'm sure that there are still a lot of people who don't like where they are. If you have ants in a place that you don't want them, what can you do that maybe will inflict the least amount of damage on the environment?
What we would like to do is treat the nest location. That is, can we back up to where the ants are coming from and limit the amount of insecticide we put into the environment by treating just the nest site? Now, when it's an anthill in your backyard, that's kind of easy to do, that you can treat that anthill with an insecticide dust or an insecticide granule, and you'll knock the population back for a while, and you will have done minimal impact on the environment, but you will have reduced the population at its source. When you have ants wandering through your kitchen, you see them on your windowsill, you see them walking across your counter, it's much harder to track back and figure out where they are coming from. So we would like to spend time watching ants. We wish they would be a little more revealing in where they're coming from, but that we would like to track them back and treat just the source if we can.
All right, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. It's Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa. With me, Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis. We've been talking about ants, and of course, he'll answer any of your ant or other insect-related questions. We will also be answering your plant and tree questions with Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Geron and DNR District Forester Mark Bitosh. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and with me, Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis. Now, Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Drawn is here. Hello, Richard.
Good morning.
And DNR District Forester Mark Vitosh. Hello, Mark.
Good morning.
And, of course, you are also welcome to join the conversation. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Or you can tweet us at IPR Talk, and we've already got an ant question on the phone for you, Donald. This is Jim in Dubuque. Hi, Jim.
Hi, ho, hi, ho.
Hi, what would you like to talk about?
Well, my latest guilty pleasure is on YouTube is finding these videos of people who are making castings of ant colonies. You melt some metal, lead or steel or something, and you find like a fire ant colony. You pour the metal into there. It flows into all the spaces. After the metal cools, you dig it up, and you have a really beautiful work of art there where you can see all the chambers and whatnot that the ants have made. It's interesting comparing the different colonies by the different species of ants. Biggest one I've seen so far is some ant in Australia that is like a half inch long. Bowl something or other. Can't remember the name of it. Mm-hmm. But are there any species like that in Iowa that make colonies that would be large enough to make it worthwhile trying to do one of these castings?
I think some of our prairie and roadside field ant nests might lend themselves to that. When you talk about those castings, it's just incredible the intricacy of the interwoven tunnels and chambers that the ants have created underground by carrying all that dirt out. I did that once in my life, Jim. We poured liquid latex down into a cicada killer burrow, a wasp burrow, and made this casting of what it looked like. And well, it's not quite as interesting because it's pretty much just a straight tube down to the bottom. But field ants would be a fun one to do because they make such huge mounds. When you see those mounds of soil alongside the road that are 3 feet high and 6 feet in diameter, those are field ants. And I think it's going to be hard to come up with an individual opening where you pour the molten metal. And I think about that also in my backyard as I'm looking at those ant mounds. Okay, where is the opening through which I would pour the metal? And I'm not sure it's very clear. It seems a little more diffuse. So we don't have harvester ants here in Iowa, but if you went a little west to Colorado, that would be a species that would make a single opening where you could come and go, where they come and go, and where you could put in the molten, but a molten metal. But it's a great project, and I love the way those look when they're all done.
Yeah, they really are incredible to see. I guess if it's an anthill you're going to treat anyway, it seems like a terrible way to go.
Well, you
maybe
know,
I'm anthropomorphizing a little bit there.
I suppose we could be very humane and suck the ants out quickly, but pouring molten metal is going to be a pretty quick death for a small ant that's trying to burrow underground. The other problem, of course, is the soil is going to very quickly absorb the heat. And so somebody who knows a whole lot about metal casting has figured out how to make the metal liquid long enough to penetrate the entire burrow.
Well, Jim, thank you so much for your call. You can give us a call, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Here's an email from Cliff in Iowa City. I have a Bradbury's Monarda, I don't know if I'm saying that right, that just finished blooming. With other mint family plants, I have aggressively cut back the leaves to encourage a second growth and bloom. Will my Monarda respond the same way? If I won't get a second bloom, I'd rather leave the flowers to develop seeds.
Typically, they will, if given a chance. Not always. Depends upon the weather. But typically, they oftentimes do. So I would say oftentimes, yes.
All right. Here's an email from Derek. We have a neighbor who loves plants but doesn't like to take care of them, so his yard is a bit unsightly. Just recently, he decided to cut down some tall bushes that were great for privacy. What are some fast-growing trees or bushes that get tall but not too tall? They would be on the north side of the house and about 10 feet from the house. So I'm guessing Derek wants to replace those.
He wants a screen.
Yes. Well, I would look at some of our native species like arrowwood viburnum, a number of the different dogwoods, nannyberry viburnum. If you wanted to add some wildlife habitat, you could even look at hazelnut. There's a lot of good native species. If you want something even a little taller, where you get maybe into the 10 to 15 foot, you could look at common lilac. So there's a lot of choices he could look at as far as width and size.
All right. How big would the viburnum get?
Depending on which, some of the, like arrowwood viburnum is probably in that 6 to 10 foot. Most of your dogwoods are in that 6 to 10 foot. So there's quite a few that are going to fall into that 6 to 10 foot range.
All right, and here's an email from Jim near Adel. I have heritage raspberries. I'm going for one crop in the fall. Is it best to let them get as tall as they want or make a one-time pruning now at 4 to 5 feet?
No, let them just grow because they will keep on growing until basically mid-summer or so, and then they'll start to flower and bear fruit basically in late summer, early fall. So do not prune back at this point, no.
All right, let's go to the phones. Ron is on the line in Indianola. Hi, Ron.
Hi. I lost an apple tree, and I want to replace it. And I'm wondering if it's too late in the year to do that.
No, it's not. Typically, if you go to a garden center, they're going to be basically either bald and burlapped or in containers, most likely containers, I would say, for trees, fruit trees. So you can still plant them.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call. 866-780-9100 is the number. Wilbur is up next in Sioux City. Hi, Wilbur.
Good morning.
Hi. What would you like to talk about?
I was just going to tell you my wife's remedy for getting rid of ants. And she found this on the internet. It's called ant borax. So you take a half a cup of sugar, one and a half tablespoons of borax, and a cup and a half of warm water, and mix it all together, and then soak some trays with cotton balls or paper towels, set them out. Ants go crazy for it, and then they disappear. They take them back to wherever they came from. But it works. It works really good.
It works some of the time for some of the people, based on the observations and the phone calls we get. If you would just add a little onion powder to that, we could call it the recipe from Heloise, which has been around for a long time. Of course, one of the distractions from this particular recipe is it will only be attractive to sweet-feeding ants. It will not be attractive to scavengers like carpenter ants. It will not be attractive to grease ants. It will only be those that are interested in feeding on sweets, which is one of our big groups of ants, but it's by no means all of the ants. Boron is a good toxicant for insects, and we can get boron in several ways. Actually, the boric acid powder that is sold as an insect control will be a little more effective than the borax, which is a laundry detergent, or Boraxo, or that type of a product. So there's some merit to this. There's some good. We hear 50-50 on this from the reports we get back from people. I tried it. It didn't work. Other people say I tried it and it worked marvelously well. I think it depends on, to a certain extent, the species of ant you've got, and it also depends on how lucky you are.
All right, Wilbur, thanks a lot for your call. Next up, let's go to John in Des Moines. Hi, John.
Good morning. I have an interesting situation that I run into frequently. I help monitor bluebird boxes. And often we will find a complete nest of ants in with the bluebirds or other species of birds. Now, a lot of times there will be hundreds of eggs, and the ants, as long as we open the boxes, you know, slowly and gently, don't really disturb the ants. Even if there are baby birds in there, it doesn't seem to have any effect. If we disturb them and they're moving around a lot, we'll sprinkle some diatomaceous earth in there. But they seem to be symbiotic in a sense. I suppose if there's anything that the birds leave as droppings or anything, the ants maybe help clean that up. I really don't know. Do you have any ideas on that?
I know ants will take up residence wherever they can, and we see that in houses where they'll nest in wall voids, they'll nest in hollow doors. So a bluebird house seems to be a good sheltered location. I've also seen them in electrical boxes. When I open up the little sealed weatherproof electrical box that holds the timer for my security lights, there are ants that have moved in there and set up residence. So I think this is just a part of getting a sheltered location and working there. I'm glad to hear that the ants don't appear to be bothering the baby birds, because that would be one of those things that you would think, oh, maybe they're going to stay there and pinch the birds or somehow harass them or begin to feed on them. But I think there are different ant species that do that, and I'm glad to hear that it's not a problem for your bluebirds. That's encouraging.
John, thanks a lot for your call. Let's go back to some of our email questions. And, of course, you're welcome to ask your questions at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me today, Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis, ISU Extension horticulturist Richard Giron, and DNR District Forester Mark Vitosh. And, Mark, this one's for you from Kevin. He says, our neighbors have a few 25-foot Scotch pine trees that seemingly have been in gradual decline for the past few years. A lot of browning needles and drop. Not sure they're going to investigate possible causes. I believe you've mentioned in the past these trees are susceptible to a number of things. Can you recommend eventual pine, fir, or spruce replacements for these?
So there's a lot of problems with Scotch pine. One of the most common is a condition called pine wilt, which is related to a beetle and a microscopic nematode, which often those trees will die in 5 to 8 weeks in the summertime. But there's a number of needle casts. There's also Zimmerman pine moth that works on the branch connections. So that's why we haven't recommended Scotch pine for many years. The big thing is, as far as Iowa, it's a tough conifer state. We've talked about this before. There's not a ton of different selections. We're looking at different opportunities or different possibilities of different species. Just like with any plant, and I should have mentioned this on the shrubs too, it's important to know what the soil conditions and how much room you have to grow and all those things before you try to fit what you want in there. But some of our species that have done okay are things like our eastern white pine, which is our only native white pine, some of the arborvitae selections. But if you have deer populations, deer love white pine and arborvitae or northern white cedar. Another one that's done okay is Norway spruce. It's a very large conifer. And then one of my favorites, not everybody likes it, but our eastern red cedar, which is Juniperus virginiana. It's actually a juniper. So there's a few out there. Another one I would throw in there, depending on soils, condition, room to grow, concolor fir does okay. And another spruce that some people have looked at is one called Serbian spruce. But I would stay away from, like, blue spruce. We have a lot of disease. I mean, every year we get tons of calls. Why is my blue spruce dying from the bottom up and those kind of things? So it's a short list. But the key is to look at your soil conditions, because most conifers like a soil condition that is moist but well-drained. So if you have a clay, wet soil, most conifers aren't going to do well in that case.
All right. Do you want to defend the eastern red cedar to us a little bit,
Mark? Well, no. It's just it doesn't have a lot of disease or insect problems. It's a great windbreak tree. It doesn't look the best in the wintertime with its color, but it's one that seems to have been pretty adaptable to our summers, which a lot of our conifers, we know that conifers, like the firs and stuff, were native to northern Iowa. We know historically, we've got evidence of that. But as the temperatures increased, as the glaciers went north, conifers don't do as well in Iowa. And that a lot of those stresses make it difficult. And that's one that the big thing is diversity. If they're going to plant, if they need three or four plants and they're just doing kind of little growth, I would actually think of two or three different ones, because that way, if you have a disease problem, you don't lose everything.
All right. And let's get back to the phones. Jim in Des Moines was inspired by your defense of ants, Donald. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Charity. I've been waiting my whole life to recite this poem by Ogden Nash. The ant has made himself illustrious through constant industry. Industrious. But so what? Would you be calm and placid if you were filled with formic acid?
That's a great one. I use that in my class when we talk about ants. And of course, college students today have never heard of Ogden Nash. So I'm doing my part to bring back an older cultural reference. But the formic acid is the same thing that's in vinegar. And people often comment that you crush an ant, it sort of smells like vinegar. Yes, that's because they're full of formic acid, and that helps keep them industrious as well.
Well, and Jim, I'm delighted that we were able to help a lifelong dream come to fruition today. So,
absolutely. Thank you, Charity.
Yep. Bye.
Bye.
866-780-9100 is the number to call. And here is a question from Chris in West Des Moines. Hi, Chris.
Hi there.
Hi. What's your question?
I have quite a few carpenter ants outside the house, and they seem to congregate around a fairly large pin oak. But I've also seen them around a silver maple that I have. We bought our house 6 years ago, and when we moved in, I saw some frass in a garden-level window area. Clean that out and haven't seen them in the house since that time, but I still see them outside around these trees, and mm-hmm. just wondering what I can do to get rid of these guys, because I don't know where the colony is, and I just am at a loss for for how to treat these guys.
Right. Well, it's not actually necessary to treat them if they're not getting into your house, if they're not damaging something that you value, like firewood or two-by-fours of your house structure. And you're lucky that they're not in the house. Most people who call and have questions about big black ants, and that's usually synonymous with carpenter ant, are complaining about them indoors. My guess is the carpenter ants are located in that silver maple tree, and silver maples are almost always hollow, and that hollowness is because of decayed wood. The wood was soft to begin with. If any moisture gets in, decay sets up, and that is the carpenter ant's preferred nesting site. Outdoors, they're also in stumps. They're in logs on the ground, hollow trees, dead limbs. Those are the kinds of places where we see the colonies. To help you locate the colony, I would suggest you get out your miner's helmet with the light on the front and go out and look around at night. That after dark, the ants will be more abundant, and maybe you can track them back to a source at that point.
And can I use a headlamp? Do I need the helmet for something? Or is
no,
it...
no. The headlamp alone will do it, Charity. I just figured Chris sounds like a guy who owns a miner's helmet. That's all.
All right. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. It's Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa. With me, ISU entomologist Donald Lewis, ISU Extension horticulturist Richard Duran, and DNR District Forester Mark Bittosh. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. With me, DNR District Forester Mark Bittosh, Iowa State University Extension Horticulturist Richard Duran, and ISU Extension Entomologist Donald Lewis. They are here to answer your questions, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. We've got another carpenter ants question on the line. Here's Gary incoming. Hi, Gary.
Hi, Charity. How are you?
Good. What's your question about?
Good. Well, it kind of goes hand in glove, as you said, with the previous caller. I've got a maple tree, and it's probably about 20 years old. I don't think it's silver, to be honest with you. I'm not sure what it is. But about 5 feet off the ground, a couple of years ago, a big branch broke off in a storm, and it left behind a rather gaping hole. It goes in about 3 inches into the tree, and it's probably about 3 inches wide and about 6 inches deep. And the last couple of years in the summertime, I've noticed that there's some frass, as a previous caller mentioned, and I know there are carpenter ants in there. And I've treated it with, you know, I put some pruning seal in it initially to seal up that hole so that insects wouldn't get in there. And they're still in there, and I don't, mm-hmm. I don't know what to do with that hole or the ants. I don't know if my tree is good or bad. Any suggestions? I mean, should I treat the ants with insecticide, the ortho, like the carpenter ant, insecticide, mm-hmm. and then seal it up with concrete or something?
Oh, or no. Oh, no, no. You've made everybody in the studio shudder at the thought of concrete in a tree. No, we don't do that anymore. Well, that's a lot of questions, Gary. And we'll start with the fact that carpenter ants nest in that softened, decayed wood. And in order to build chambers and galleries and tunnels, they chew up the wood and they carry sawdust to the entrance and they drop the sawdust. And those piles of fresh sawdust are just an indication that the carpenter ants are working inside the decayed wood. The carpenter ants are not your problem. We could put insecticide dust into that opening and we would kill most of the carpenter ants and maybe we could keep them out for the rest of this year. But that decayed wood and that open wound is where carpenter ants want to be, and they will find their way back. So you can kill the ants, but that's not your problem. So a forester looking at a wound that size on a tree in the backyard?
I think he has some thoughts to share.
What next?
So thank you, Donald. So I was even going to go back to Chris in West Des Moines. Is for him, for a larger silver maple, if I have carpenter ants, my first concern is that tree structurally sound. So I would suggest that Chris have an arborist look at his tree to see if it's structurally sound. To go to Gary's tree, even though it's a smaller tree, the challenge is if you have a wound like that, there's no way to seal it. You can put foam in it. They've tried cement. They've tried asphalt. They used to put bricks. The thing is, if you have decay, you can't seal it. If you seal it, you actually keep the moisture in, and it actually promotes decay. People have even taken vacuum cleaners and wet vaced it out and tried to clean it all up and everything and then seal it. There's still enough moisture in there that you can't do anything. And the challenge is when a branch breaks like that, it leaves a pretty irregular wound, and it's difficult for the tree to try to seal itself. It tries. It's actually called compartmentalization, and that's what a tree does to defend itself to decay. But when a branch is broken irregularly, that system kind of gets broken. If that tree is not very close to the house, the thing is decay will not kill that tree. It's more of a structural thing. If that tree is closer to the house, then as that tree gets bigger, eventually, if that wound is, you know, 4 or 5 feet or 6 or 8 feet and you have all that crown up top, that's going to be a weak spot. Eventually, in the right windstorm or whatever, that could snap. So as it gets bigger, that tree could be a concern. If it's out further away from the house and if it failed, I'd just let it go. Knowing that you're going to have decay, treat, like he said, treat the ants. But if it's closer to the house, that's going to be a long-term situation. So I would almost even evaluate, is there a way to maybe put a different tree close by, get it started, and then consider removing that tree before it gets too big and too much of a concern.
All right. And let's move on to our next question. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. And Jim is on the line in Mason City. Hi, Jim.
Good day. Hey, I got a question. I have three pink spires. They're probably at least 20 years old. But the bark now is starting to, like, fall off or on the bottom of the trees. Is that just a sign of age, or they suffer apple scab terribly? Is there any help in these things, or turn them into firewood?
I would look at the depth at which they're coming. For most crab apples, once they get 15 to 20 years old, that bark is going to start to crevice and sometimes plate. If you can actually see into the wood, then there could be something else going on there. But if it's just kind of platey and peely, for most crab apples, that's pretty normal. If you look higher up in the tree, the bark should still be fairly smooth. And as you come down, it's going to get rougher and rougher. If that's what you're seeing, you're looking at bark development most likely.
Well, this you can actually see the wood.
That does not sound good.
that's bad news.
That's what I thought. I mean, the inside of the bark between, you know, the bark and the tree, it's almost black and slimy.
That sounds pretty not good. That's the best way I could say it. So
that sounds like firewood.
It does. I would give it some time. The one thing I would look for is to see if there's any callus tissue, which is this wound wood that tries to close these wounds. See if there's any callus tissue on the edges of where that bark is coming off, where it could start to try to seal. If you see some of that, I think it's worth, you know, crab apples aren't very big, so not really a hazard situation. So you could give it some time. But if it's a, you know, more than 50% of the circumference of the trunk, it's going to get probably worse and worse if you don't have that callus tissue coming.
All right. Well, I think the option is chainsaw.
Okay. But I would look for that callus tissue first.
All right, I will.
Okay.
Yeah, good luck, Jim. Thanks a lot for your call. Next up, we've got Christopher in Ottumwa who needs some advice from you, Donald, about what to feed ants. Hi, Christopher.
Well, hey there. So I just had a question, another ant question. I was wondering what ants from Illinois like to eat. My aunt's driving out from Chicago, and I told her I'd take her out to dinner.
Nice. I love it. I did not grow up in a culture that used the pronunciation aunt.
No.
And I guess that's kind of a southern, upper Midwestern joke that Christopher has given us, what to feed your aunt. And I love it. I'd probably be using that in class in the next day or two.
Try red lobster. Then.
Right. No, I would suggest a picnic. Ants love picnics, right?
Ants go to a picnic. So that's right. Let's get the red tablecloth out, fill up the basket with some sandwiches and some potato salad, and go sit under a tree and eat.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call. Christopher, Larry's on the line next in Clinton. Hi, Larry.
Hello. I have three things. One is I have some raspberries that produce twice a year. What's coming up from the ground now will produce in the fall.
Mm-hmm.
And then I trim those out in the wintertime. Just trim the tops off where it's dying out. And that will produce in early summer.
Correct.
Which is right now. They're
correct.
Producing right now. And I wanted to know what type of raspberry that was. These were given to me years ago. And they produce like crazy and they spread like crazy too.
Well, it could be Heritage. Heritage has been around for a long time. There are a number of newer cultivars, but Heritage would probably be my best guess. Heritage.
Okay. Okay, because I have a lot of people always ask me that. So I. Okay, the second thing is I have oak blight. I got a bur oak. And I know it's oak blight because I sent it into the state, and they tested it, and it said, yeah, that's what it was. So I had a guy come over, and he said, one of the guys that's going to inject the tree, but he said he'd come back in the spring or late or early summer to see how bad it is right now. But it hasn't shown up. And it was like half the tree last year, and this year it's not shown up so far.
So, Larry, that usually shows up mid to late July. So I haven't seen it yet, and I have some areas in my district where I do see it. So we still got a couple weeks to a month. And I think the way the weather conditions have been for a lot of different diseases, I think there is potential for it to show up again. The weather has a big impact, but that fungus overwinters on the dead leaves that tend to hang on the tree. So those spores are right there. So I think there is a good chance that you're still going to see it, but it's usually in that mid to late July up through like early August. So I still think if you don't see it, that's awesome. But I think with the weather, we still have potential for it to show up.
Okay. And the last thing. A couple weeks ago, you had something on Creeping Charlie,
mm-hmm.
and I just caught the back end of the show, so I didn't. So I have a Creeping Charlie problem, but what I use on it is 20 Mule Team Borax, and I put one cup of that into a gallon of water and take a sprayer and go out there and spray all the leaves of the Creeping Charlie, and it usually the first treatment, and has to do it on a nice hot day. So the sun beats down on it, and the first treatment usually takes about half the Creeping Charlie away, and it doesn't bother the grass.
Well,
so then
yeah,
I just do it again. Yeah,
it can bother the grass. Borax contains boron, and boron can also be toxic to turf grass. So the key there in using borax is putting on a certain amount, and I think for most people they don't fully understand that. And if they apply it very heavily, they'll basically kill everything, the ground ivy, the grass, everything. So I typically, for that reason, suggest a herbicide that is selective in nature.
All right. And the time of year for that is not now, right?
It's in the fall, yes.
All right. Good luck with that. Thanks a lot for your call. Here's a question from Jill for you, Donald. I just found a brown wedge-shaped insect about the size of a BB on the lower leaves of some prematurely yellowing or browning sunflower leaves that look attacked. And it seemed to fly straight up in the air when I tried to confine it for identification. What could it be?
Wow. A brown wedge-shaped insect on sunflowers. Number one, I doubt that that's the pest. The sunflowers could just have ragged leaves for a lot of reasons. There could have been leaf feeders there in the past that aren't causing the problem now. Even on lower leaves, it could be things like slugs and cutworms that have come up to feed. The leaf hopper sounding thing that flies up when she gets there would be a sap feeding insect, and it would not be causing the ragged appearance of the leaves. So I'm going to stick with my guess of some kind of leaf hopper, which gives me about 8,000 different chances to be right. So we're going to stick with that.
All right. The odds are in your favor.
That's right.
All right. Here is a question from Tim in Iowa City. I planted a catalpa tree from seed 5 years ago, and it's grown to over 20 feet, flowering for the first time this year and appeared to be flourishing until about 10 days ago. Now about half the tree's leaves are wilting. It appears to be from the bottom up, started on one side and has progressed to the other. Is there any hope for this tree?
My theme today is it doesn't sound good. One of the conditions that can show up this time of year is a disease called verticillium wilt, and catalpa is one that is kind of susceptible. So if it kind of came out in a portion wilted. Now, the one thing with verticillium wilt, there's a great publication from Iowa State that he can look up. I mean, it could be something else, but that is one possibility. So there's a good publication on it. But what happens with that disease sometimes, if the tree is not completely stressed, it can sometimes compartmentalize that disease. So depending on what branches, sometimes you'll just get individual branches that will die, and it will actually wall off the disease, and it'll continue. So all I can really do is kind of wait and see what happens.
All right. Here's a question from Nick in Iowa City. I have a bird feeder and bird bath in my backyard. The Zika and West Nile concerns suggest getting rid of standing water. Any way to provide water for the birds but not mosquitoes?
Yes. Clean the bird bath every week. You don't have to get rid of it. You just have to flush it.
And is that as simple as dumping it and filling it with a hose, or do you have to actually scrub it out?
Well, I can't tell that the birds really care how clean my bird bath is, so I don't even dump it. I just hit the little pool of water that's left when I get around to it. I hit it with a stream of from the garden hose, okay. And I sort of flush it over the side for the benefit of the plants.
Love it.
And then fill it back up. So you just have to avoid stagnant standing water for 7 to 10 days. So you clean the bird bath, you dump over the buckets, you make sure the kids' wading pool that you kick to the backyard isn't accumulating water that stands for that period of 7 to 10 days. And you can do that just by cleaning them out on a periodic basis. Mosquitoes are on the increase right now, and they're loving all the standing water that's around the state, and we don't want to add to that. But there are a lot of places where mosquitoes are going to breed, whether we take care of our bird bath or not. But we want to take care of our own property and not contribute to the problem. So flush the bird bath.
All right. And Evelyn from Fairfield is on the line. Hi, Evelyn.
Hi.
Hi. What's your question?
Oh, well, you said that we didn't have any fire ants in Iowa, but I'm down here in southeast Iowa, and I had some topsoil that I'd moved locally, and I had it covered with a blue tarp, and when I took it off a few weeks ago, it was covered with like 10,000 almost microscopic little red ants, and that night we had a big rainstorm, and then they all disappeared. I moved all the topsoil and never found another one, but it was loaded, but they were microscopic, and they were bright red.
Mm-hmm. All right, red ants.
We have red ants. We have lots of different colors of ants. We have two-toned ants and black ones and brown ones, but we do not have the red imported fire ant, Solenopsis invicta. It's a very specific species that has moved from about Florida across to Texas and up into Arkansas. We don't have that species of red ant, but we do have other red ants. So you're going to find a lot of varieties of ants out there, but until climate change brings us much more tropical weather, that one species isn't going to be our problem. It's going to be someone else's.
And when you see a red ant, I know a lot of people get scared. Are they more likely to bite?
Not that I'm aware of. I just think it's the reputation that they're going to cause a problem.
All right. Well, Donald Lewis, thank you so much for being here today.
Glad to do it. And even though ants appear busy, they always have time to go to a picnic.
Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis. Richard Giron, thank you.
You're welcome.
ISU Extension horticulturist Richard Giron and Mark Vitosh, thank you.
Thank you.
DNR District Forester Mark Vitosh will be back again with Horticulture Day next Friday on Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Have a great weekend.